Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, Local Clothier Expanding Hits $50 Million Mark. And this article runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far left, there's a picture of two men standing next to a dummy with a suit, one of their designs. The caption reads, Chris Knott and Scott Mahoney head up Peter Millar. And this article was written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. As the Peter Millar clothing line gains national exposure on NBC Sports and in Neiman Marcus and other retail stores, its headquarters and operations center in Cary has been busting at the seams. Orders for Peter Millar, pronounced Millar, sports coats, golf shirts, and sportswear for men and women have exploded in recent years as the brand's popularity among golf's elite and luxury lifestyle shoppers has grown. CEO Scott Mahoney says sales grew by 48% in 2010 and are on track to grow another 40% with about $50 million in wholesale revenue for 2011. You look back 5 years ago and there were 10 cars in the parking lot. Now you can't hardly find a parking space, Mahoney says. The company's employee base is now double at 75 compared to 2 years ago. To help keep up with demand, Peter Millar will relocate its operations and distribution warehouse to the Imperial Center Business Park in Durham in September. It will occupy space in the Commerce Center building on Emperor Boulevard that's almost twice the size of the 29,000-square-foot brick-and-metal building the company has occupied since shortly after founder Chris Knott started the company in 2002. Peter Millar also will open a design studio in November at the restored historic Pilot Mill building in downtown Raleigh. There, its marketing and sales staff will host seminars and welcome clients from across the country to come see Peter Millar's newest apparel lines and its designers at work. Branding the Millar line of clothing has been helped considerably by arrangements the company has formed with professional golfers and with NBC Sports. Members of the U.S. team, captained by PGA pro Fred Couples, will be outfitted with Peter Millar apparel when they play for the President's Cup in Australia. Multiple other PGA Tour players have apparel deals to wear the Peter Millar shirts and its logo, including veterans Ben Curtis and Bill Haas. And Peter Millar outfits all of the on-air talent for NBC Sports weekend golf coverage and for the network's Tour de France cycling competition coverage in July. Menswear sales have been one of the few bright spots in the apparel industry in the down economy, as some men are now trying to add style to their lifestyle, says Marshall Cohen, an apparel industry expert and chief industry analyst for retail trend tracking company NPD Group. In recent past, the technology was their priority. Now, looking the part, dressing for success both in and out of the office has become a focus for men, Cohen says. Today is about separating yourself from the competition. Cohen says stores like Saks Fifth Avenue, Nordstrom, and Neiman Marcus are favored for luxury and investment wardrobing, but that mid-level stores also are seeing investments in men's wardrobes. Look for this trend to continue into 2012. It is rare when the men's market leads the fashion industry, but when it does, it sticks around for a while, he says. Nordstrom carries Peter Millar in most of its stores across the country, including its location at the Streets at South Point Mall in Durham. Neiman Marcus added the brand at about 38 of its 43 stores across the country in 2010. Peter Millar products also were sold at more than 1,000 golf clubs and at 350 specialty stores across the country. And we'll stop there with that article. The rest of the article details more about where the clothing can be found at local stores. Instead, we'll move down the page, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The next article is in the middle of the page. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, first at the top in bold black lettering is the headline, Costly Commutes, Triangle's Toll Road Will Be Among More Expensive. And then right under that, the article starts on the left side. On the right side, there's a picture of the exit sign on the highway getting to RDU Airport. And then under that, there's another longer picture showing a line of toll booths, the kind you're normally seeing, you usually see in other states where they have toll booths. The caption on the picture, the toll booth picture, reads, Triangle Parkway will not have toll booths such as this one, relying instead on transponders and cameras. Now, this article was written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Holly Springs. The Triangle Expressway, the state's first toll road and the nation's first without collection booths, also will be among the most expensive for drivers. Those who drive it from NC 147 to Holly Springs will be charged as much as $4.15 when the 19-mile section is completed next year. For someone who drives the road 5 days a week for 50 weeks in a year, the annual cost would be $1,038. A proposed route would fully encircle Raleigh, connecting with I-540 near Knightdale. For drivers who don't buy remote payment devices called transponders, the rate of 22.2 cents a mile compares to 16 cents a mile on a toll road in Greenville, South Carolina, 13 cents a mile on a route in Austin, Texas, and 8 cents a mile on both the New Jersey Turnpike and a short toll highway in Atlanta. A handful of major toll roads are even more expensive, ranging as high as 52 cents per mile on one road in Orange County, California. The local tollway also is relatively expensive for transponder outfitted cars, but the 14.5 cents a mile they will pay represents a relatively generous 35% discount. The 14.5 cent rate is just above average compared to a selection of U.S. toll systems that use transponders, according to an economic analysis used to set rates here. As on tollways in Texas and several other locations, a system on the Triangle Expressway entrances films license tags of cars without transponders and matches the plates with registration information on file with departments of motor vehicles in North Carolina and elsewhere. Those drivers are billed via mail. The economic analysis, produced in 2009 by Wilbur Smith Associates in New Haven, Connecticut, was aimed largely at determining ways to maximize revenue. It considered a range of factors, including the value that Triangle drivers place on their time and the likelihood that excessive rates would divert traffic and erode revenue. Andy Lelewski, director of toll road operations for the North Carolina Turnpike Authority, says the agency set rates just below levels that would maximize revenue. Toll rates on many roads around the nation haven't risen in years because they weren't designed to increase annually, as in Texas, or because raising toll rates is politically difficult for elected officials, Lelewski says. Development and maintenance costs were not important factors in determining the rates for the Triangle Parkway, but the revenue projections in the analysis point to the road's $1 billion cost being recouped in 40 to 50 years. Land acquisition is a leading cost in large road projects. One 120-acre assemblage of land near a Triangle Expressway route, for example, was recently valued at about $18 million, according to co-owner Rob Gibson. Tolls notwithstanding, time is money, and the Triangle Expressway is designed to save it for drivers who are expected to roll through with less waiting than toll plazas tend to require. Toll roads in some states even require drivers to slow or stop multiple times, either to toss coins into a funnel or to pass through narrow gates. While the 11.5-mile Powhite Parkway near Richmond, Virginia, is cheaper at about 13 cents a mile, cash-paying drivers must stop twice, Richmond Metropolitan Authority spokeswoman Linda McElroy says. And now we move just to the right of that article. This article runs vertically along the right side of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And first, at the top, there's a picture of three men casually dressed standing outside. The caption reads, Argyle CEO Eric Boggs with colleagues Joshua Smith and Mike Novi. And then under that, there's the headline, Argyle Growing in Social Media. And this article is written by Monica Chen with the Dateline of Durham. Argyle Social, a social media startup in downtown Durham that's less than 2 years old, has landed $1.24 million in a Series A round to fund product and sales expansions. The company, which had just two people when it raised a $325,000 seed round in October 2010, now has 11 employees and is hiring for four more software developers and sales associates. With the bewildering array of products in social media space, the industry segment is a difficult one in which to stand out. Eric Boggs, co-founder and CEO of Argyle, is banking on continued growth of social media marketing to take his company to the next level. Our space is very competitive, but it's also white hot, Boggs says. I think we have a chance to build a 100-employee company in downtown Durham. Argyle is fulfilling a niche in the mid-sized business market by delivering a software-as-a-service product that consolidates multiple social media platforms in one space. Users can post messages to Facebook, Twitter, blogs, and other platforms. Those messages can be scheduled and tweaked for different audiences. The program also keeps track of replies and provides analytics, such as data on conversions and leads acquired. Boggs, who declined to provide revenue specifics, says the company now has hundreds of customers worldwide. Its products are sold on a subscription basis at $149 a month for the basic product and $499 a month for premium. Will Devlin, digital marketing manager of Gander Mountain, a St. Paul, Minnesota-based outdoor apparel and gear retailer, says the unique visits to the company's website has grown from 118,000 Facebook fans in February to 300,000, largely because of the ability to engage customers and change strategies quickly by using Argyle's product. Devlin manages social media content for four brands with Gander Mountain. We were sold on their commitment to continuously evolve the product, which is key as social media constantly evolves, Devlin says. Argyle was founded in December 2009 by Boggs and business partner Adam Corbati, the chief technology officer. Both are veterans of Bronto Software and in fact held the same program manager position at the Durham-based email marketing company, first Boggs, then Corbati, prior to starting their own company. The Series A round was led by Madison Square Ventures, a new investment entity in the Triangle, with participation from existing inventor Idea Fund Partners and new investor Greg Cangelosi, founder of email marketing service Blue Sky Factory. Jim Tobin, president of Ignite Social Media in Cary, serves as an advisor to the company. Idea Fund, located in downtown Durham, has been involved in Argyle since 2010 via NC Idea Fund, an affiliated nonprofit that awards grants to help germinate startups, often at the earliest stage in the entrepreneurial process. Argyle had received a $33,000 grant from NC Idea Fund to help the founders create a prototype. Idea Fund is also an investor in other growing healthcare and tech firms in the Triangle, including StatSheet, Axial Exchange, Oncoscope, and Eye Contact. Customers are using social media tools and companies want to go where the customers are, says Lister Delgado, general manager of Idea Fund. What is happening now is that companies want to figure out how to best get to these customers. That's where Argyle comes in. A recent Duke University survey of chief marketing officers shows that despite the challenging economy, social media marketing spending is on the upswing. The CMOs expect to increase social media spending from 7.1% of overall marketing budget to 10.1% over the next year. In the next 5 years, they expect to see this number rise to 17.5%. The business-to-consumer marketing segment reported the largest anticipated increase over 5 years, from 10.5% currently to 24%. Boggs, who has seen the changes and growth in the email marketing space, sees social media marketing heading down the same path. The bet that we're making is that social will grow out of its infancy into a meaningful marketing channel, Boggs says. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This one runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. The headline, Peace Fast-Tracking Men's Sports as a Way to Juice Enrollment. And then on the far left side, there's a picture of a female basketball player during a game wearing number 11. The caption reads, Crystal Austin plays for the Peace College Pacers women's basketball team, soon to be joined by a men's team. And this article was written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. In a bid to help jumpstart its transition to a co-ed institution, Peace College will launch men's varsity basketball, cross-country, and golf in conjunction with the arrival of the first male students in fall 2012. In 2013, the college will add soccer and baseball to reach the goal of 5 varsity men's sports teams in the USA South Athletic Conference by 2015, says Athletic Director Kelly Johnson. It is ambitious, but that's what our goal will be, says Johnson. Getting a men's sports program off the ground quickly could help early enrollment, says Chad McAvoy, an associate professor of sport management at Illinois State University. It is quite common in Division III athletics for sports programs to be used as an enrollment booster, he says. Because the National Collegiate Athletic Association does not permit scholarships at the Division III level, the athletes are essentially paying customers, McAvoy says. It wouldn't surprise me at all if they were using this as a way to attract more men to attend the school. Several current and former students have protested the decision to take the women's school co-ed and change the name to William Peace University. But Board of Trustees Chairman Todd Robinson says that won't affect the university's ability to raise money in general or for men's sports specifically. There are actually many supporters of this move, and we do not anticipate any funding challenges, he wrote in an email. Funding for men's sports will come from university operations, he says, not from a capital campaign. The men's teams will not immediately join the 11-member USA South, where all six women's teams already compete. They will be classified as a developmental varsity program for 1 year and join the conference in the respective second years, Johnson says. Johnson will schedule as many USA South opponents as possible, but the classification allows him to schedule games against junior varsity and junior college teams as well. He declined to discuss the athletic budget, but says the men's program would be funded from the university's operations budget and would be in addition to what the women's programs receive. Our goal is not to take any money away from the women's programs, he says. Changes to facilities will be the most immediate capital project, Johnson says. The university will add male locker rooms for the basketball team and will find a field for the baseball team to play. The women's soccer team competes at Wake Med Soccer Park in Cary, where the men will also play. The women's softball team plays on the campus field, and the basketball teams can play in the same gym on campus. For cross country and golf, the men and women can compete on the same courses. When asked about starting a football program, Johnson laughed and said, "You never say never, but that would definitely be down the road." He pointed out that Florida State University at one point was an all-female college. "I think we are focused on the other sports right now," Johnson says. "It's a process. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think we will be able to have our teams compete sooner rather than later." Founded in 1857, Peace enrolls 700 students each year and boasts an 11-to-1 student-to-faculty ratio and a 91% four-year graduation rate. And after the article, there's a green box that has some quick facts in it. Actually, the caption for it is, "Here come the Peace Pacer men." And the quick facts under that: fall 2012, men's sports to launch, basketball, cross-country, golf. Fall 2013, men's sports to launch, baseball and soccer. And then under that it says, Peace College will remain a member of the Division III USA South Athletic Conference. Peace's men's teams will be competing in conference play in 2013. Besides Peace, members of the conference are Everett University, Christopher Newport University, Ferrum College, Greensboro College, Mary Baldwin College, Maryville College, Methodist University, North Carolina Wesleyan College, and Shenandoah University. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off: ghostly offer to entice guests to Carolina Inn. Want to sleep with a ghost? The Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill is offering the Room with a Boo package that features overnight accommodations for two in room 256 starting at $409. Room 256 is the room favored by the inn's resident ghost, Dr. William J. Cox, but don't fear, like Casper, he's a friendly ghost. And yes, there was, or is, depending on your belief system, a Dr. J. Cox who took up residence in room 256 in 1948 and stayed there for 17 years before his passing, ending his time at the Carolina Inn. Or did he? Besides the room, the Boo package includes dinner for two, set for three at Carolina Crossroads Restaurant, a biography of Dr. J. Cox, and a complimentary copy of A History of the Carolina Inn, signed by author Dr. Ken Zagri. Young Raleigh golfer Grayson Murray, 18, had a decision to make when he qualified to compete in the Thunderbird International Junior Invitational at Greyhawk Golf Club in Scottsdale, Arizona. Pick a charity to receive a $1,000 donation in his honor. He picked the first tee of the triangle. It was an easy choice, he says. Grayson began golf practice sessions at the Triangle Golf Complex when he was 7, and there he would become familiar with the kids in the first tee classes. I got involved as a mentor to the younger children, he says, and when given the opportunity, I wanted to help make a financial contribution to these young kids starting just like I did. Also, his dad, Eric Murray, has provided scholarships to the first tee of the Triangle participants through Tar Heel Golf Foundation. The first tee of the Triangle provides life skills curriculum and character instruction through programs designed around the game of golf and has served nearly 6,000 Triangle youth since 2004. Nice round, Grayson. To commemorate the 10th anniversary of 9/11, GlaxoSmithKline employees in Research Triangle Park assembled 60,000 meals for Stop Hunger Now. On September 9, the drug giant organized employees in Philadelphia and RTP to sign up for 90-minute slots to pack meals for people without food. GSK closed its manufacturing facility in Zebulon so that 550 employees could volunteer. GSK is a national sponsor of the 9/11 Day of Service and Remembrance. This year, the company provided $500,000 towards educational outreach. Contributions totaled $1.25 million over the last 3 years. Cary's annual Lazy Days Arts Festival was canceled due to Hurricane Irene, but festival goers can still experience the arts of Lazy Days through a virtual website set up by the town of Cary. The town has set up an artist section for vendors who had planned to participate at Lazy Days at www.townofcary.org. Through the site, shoppers can view the crafts and inquire about purchasing the items. It is the second year that an inventory of arts and crafts has been available, but it's the first year the website was set up for inquiring about purchases. Items will be available online through September 30. Festival coordinator Joy Innes says that about 380 artists in 19 art media categories are featured, with items priced from $10 to more than $100. Typically held the fourth Saturday in August, Lazy Days annually draws 50,000 people to downtown Cary. But after consulting with local, state, and federal forecasters and emergency management officials, the town of Cary canceled the August 27 event due to the potential for unsafe conditions. It was the first time the 35-year event had been canceled. The show is going on. The fifth annual Triangle Corporate Battle of the Bands will rock it out on September 24 in the American Tobacco Campus in downtown Durham. The battle is showcasing a lineup of 9 bands this year from companies including Elster Solutions, Key Source Bank, and Quintiles, who have come up with quirky band names like the clever Counting CROs for Quintiles. The show, hosted by ad agency McKinney, will benefit NC Arts in Action. The shows have raised more than $300,000 for local charities since 2006. So Biz is giving special props to CEOs of companies who are going on stage for a good cause. Jim Parker, president of Summit Consulting. David Stevens, president and CEO of SunTrust Bank, Central Carolina Region. Mike Creed, chairman and CEO of McKim & Creed. Gerald Hall, president of SMT. Rock on. If you love dogs as much as Biz, don't miss this show at the North Carolina Museum of History. Through September 30, a free exhibit that delves into the history and evolution of one of the state's original citizenry will be open for viewing. No, it's not about the state's Native Americans. It's about the only breed of dog known to have originated in the Tar Heel State, the Plot Hound. The museum describes Plot Hounds as smart, tough, and relentless dogs that will chase game, including 200-pound bears, for days at a time. They are bred to hunt bears, raccoons, wild boar, and other animals. The dogs are named for Johannes Plot, who began the breed in the mid-1700s. House Autry Mills, a Johnston County seasoning mix and breader maker, is gathering up a collection of Southern-style recipes for its 200th anniversary cookbook. House Autry is asking local cooks to submit their favorite recipes that incorporate at least one House Autry product, as well as a story or family tradition behind the recipe. But only the best entries will make it into the cookbook and possibly featured on the company's Facebook page, YouTube page, or website. Entries can be submitted through November 1 at www.house, Sadly, the US Open Yes, sadly, the U.S. Open is over. The last leg of 2011's Tennis Grand Slam is now history. But don't fret, tennis lovers. You can still catch some quality net action right here in the Triangle, but you've got to get moving. Through Sunday, September 18, folks can check out the North Carolina United States Tennis Association's League Mixed Doubles State Championships. According to the city of Durham, the tournament draws more than 1,000 players annually and features champion teams from each of the 14 local leagues. Approximately 4,000 spectators, participants, and players attend the four-day event. Matches will be played at several locations around the Triangle. Visit the Durham Parks and Recreation website for details. Disney Channel star Brandon Michael Smith has tapped Raleigh PR shop French West Vaughn as his marketing and public relations agency of record. The 22-year-old star is known for his roles on Disney's Sunny with a Chance, Phil of the Future, and So Random. The North Carolina Bankers Association has invited some of the key figures in the housing industry, including Freddie Mac CEO Ed Halderman and Fannie Mae CEO Michael Williams, to speak at the American Mortgage Conference in Raleigh on September 18 through 20. The event will explore what's next in housing finance, the look of the market in coming months and years, the impact of reform. The conference is being held at the Marriott Crabtree Valley with a Sunday, September 18 golfing event at Pinehurst also scheduled. Governor Beverly Perdue is hosting a conference on entrepreneurship in September that's drawing some of the more innovative entrepreneurs throughout the state. The event, the theme of which is Breaking the Mold, which will be held at the Durham Convention Center on September 21 through 22, boasts 24 speakers. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Cameron Snipes, and Monica Chen. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to, the headline, First Citizens Follows Minority Vote on Pay. And this article runs horizontally across the top of the page. At the far left, there's a picture of two people dressed in business attire standing outside of a bank. The caption reads, Hope Holding Connell and Frank Holding Jr. head up bank. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. It might be family-controlled and closely held, but Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank has an ear for its shareholders. In April, a minority block of shareholders, 4 million out of nearly 30 million total shares voted, said they wanted an annual vote on executive pay. Now, after considering the matter during the intervening months, First Citizens' 14-member board of directors has signaled it will go along with the change. For now, says bank spokeswoman Barbara Thompson, the board could change it at any time. It all has to do with the federal Dodd-Frank reforms passed by Congress in the wake of the financial meltdown of 2008. Under it, banks and other publicly traded companies must give shareholders the right to decide how frequently they, the shareholders, will be allowed to vote on executive pay plans every year, every 2 years, or every 3 years. Going into First Citizens' annual meeting in April, the bank board was recommending the three-year so-called say-on-pay voting option. For three generations, guiding the destiny of the now $21 billion bi-coastal bank has been the Holding family, whose four active members hold shares, giving them a lock on 59% of shareholder votes. The four voting Holding family members are Executive Vice Chair Frank Holding, who controls 40%, or 3.3 million shares, CEO and Chairman Frank Holding Jr., who controls 6.8%, or 259,221 shares, Vice Chairman Hope Holding Connell, who controls 5.6%, or 221,201 shares, and Carmen Holding Ames, who controls 6.2%, or 786,853 shares, some of which are jointly held by two trusts. Only Ames, among the family members, does not hold an executive position with the company. Executive compensation votes affect family members Frank Holding Jr., and Hope Holding Connell. It is essentially a private company, says Britt Shiner of FBR Capital Markets and Company. Predictably, when the smoke cleared following April's annual meeting, 25.2 million votes favored the three-year say-on-pay option. Nearly 300,000 wanted it every 2 years, and 4.1 million wanted the pay vote to be an annual event. Nearly 100,000 abstained. Another peculiarity of Dodd-Frank, however, is that such votes are non-binding, meaning bank boards, after looking at shareholder tallies, can decide to implement the policy any way they want. That is what the First Citizens Board did by essentially overthrowing the April vote. Since a significant number of shareholders appear to prefer that a vote be held every year, the bank says in a recent SEC filing, the full bank board and its compensation committee decided to try the annual option until at least 2017, or until the board determines that a different frequency is appropriate. Some analysts see the decision as a step beyond the basic requirements of Dodd-Frank. They could have gone with the majority, but didn't, says former banking regulator Don Coker, who now consults on governance and other issues. It looks like they were trying to avoid any kind of criticism on the issue, and that's something you don't see all the time. And Paul Hodgson, a say-on-pay specialist with the Corporate Library, agrees. A vast majority of boards have recommended the three-year time period. A vast majority of shareholders have gone with 1 year. And a vast majority of boards have followed those instructions, he says. What is unusual, he adds, is for a board to side with a minority on the side of annual review. And our next article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. The headline, Ghost Park, once a vibrant development, Park Center now mostly empty. And this article is in the center of a page. It has a black border around it. And there's a greenish, light olive green background. But on top of this background, first, the top half has a large aerial photo of the space in Park Center. The caption reads, space in Park Center in RTP is 91% vacant. And then under that is the actual article. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park. The only prop missing are tumbleweeds at the once vibrant Park Center office park in the heart of the Triangle, Research Triangle Park. Park Center lost its last large tenant in March when RTI International built a new office building on its campus and moved everyone out of Park Center's largest building, the 800 Park Office Center building, with 141,000 square feet of now vacant space. All told, Park Center's eight office buildings have vacant more than 614,000 square feet of space, or 91% of the property, which is enough office space for 2,000 workers. IBM had been the anchor tenant occupying the five largest buildings for more than two decades until the company sold its computer business to Lenovo, a Chinese computer manufacturer, and Lenovo left Park Center in 2006 and in 2007 to build its own U.S. headquarters campus in Morrisville. I always worried about this Armageddon that would happen out there if IBM left, says Rob Tier, president of Tier Associates in Durham, who developed the Park Center buildings during the 1970s and 1980s. He sold the property in 1985, and an affiliate of GE Capital bought the buildings in 2002 for $65 million. Meanwhile, the bills to keep the lights on in the buildings, to keep the grass cut, and to refresh the flowers in the entrance planters continue to mount whether there's rental income or not. Plus, all of the Park Center properties operate under a long-term land lease that dates back to a concession agreement with Tier's family in 1967. Under that agreement, Park Center's owner must make annual lease payments to Research Triangle Foundation or risk default on the properties. But if there are any plans to renovate, redevelop, or recapitalize the property, no one is saying what those plans are. Neither representatives from GE Capital nor its local partner, Craig Davis Properties of Cary, responded to calls for comment. Built in the 1970s and 1980s, Park Center still has the distinction of being the only area inside RTP not constrained by RTP's research activity requirement of all tenants within park boundaries. Park Center, located near the intersection of NC 54 and Davis Drive, also has the only site designated for retail, yet its lone strip center remains empty more than 5 years after it was renovated. Only the bank branches for Wachovia, Bank of America, First Citizens, and RTP Federal Credit Union remain active. The Radisson Hotel Research Triangle Park, formerly called the Governor's Inn, is also part of Park Center, but is owned by a separate entity. RTP spokeswoman Chris Mulder says Park Center owners have not submitted any new plans for the property, but she says they have had discussions with RTP staff in recent months about the overall vision for the property and how it might fit with the development of a new master plan being developed for all of Research Triangle Park. The plan is expected to be approved in early 2012. Rex Thomas, CEO of the Grubb & Ellis Thomas Linderman Graham Real Estate Firm and chairman of the Research Triangle Park Service Center Board, says the new RTP master plan should help answer some of the questions about a future direction for Park Center. Now is not the time to do anything related to new projects, but it's certainly time to be planning for new projects, Thomas says. Dex One faces anger over pay. That's the headline on our next article. And this article has a picture above it of a man sitting on a desk wearing a suit and tie. The caption reads, CEO Alfred Mockett got $5.2 million last year. And this article is written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Cary. Dex One Corporation has posted strong revenue growth since emerging from bankruptcy in February 2010. But investors have continued to punish the internet marketing company, driving down its share price by 96%, and most recently suing board members for approving allegedly excessive executive pay. Already facing a warning that the company's listing could be removed from the New York Stock Exchange, Dex One now faces a lawsuit filed September 1 in federal court in Raleigh by Wisconsin resident Brad Haberland. He alleges that company directors abandoned shareholders' best interests by ignoring the results of a say-on-pay vote earlier this year. Haberland demands that the company align its executives' compensation more closely with shareholder returns and that they and directors repay the company an unspecified portion of the compensation received over the past 2 years. Such lawsuits in which shareholders seek no damages for themselves individually are known as shareholder derivative actions. It isn't clear whether Haberland's holdings in Dex One are substantial. His attorney, Mark Gustafson of Essex, Richards, and Charlotte, declined to comment through an assistant. The allegations made in this lawsuit are completely without merit, and we intend to vigorously defend Dex One and the other named defendants, Dex One spokesman Chris Hardman says in a prepared statement. Hardman added, all executive compensation is determined by our board of directors in consultation with independent compensation consultants. The company says 2011 pay for most executives was altered to shift incentive-based compensation away from cash and toward equity, and includes new vesting requirements for most equity compensation. New chief executive Alfred Mockett received a base salary of $300,000 and total compensation of about $5.2 million last year. Director Mike McEachin, a non-executive who heads the company's compensation committee, receives compensation totaling about $254,000, according to ISS. Say-on-pay votes, a feature of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act that was signed into law in July 2010, are now required at most companies with actively traded shares totaling at least $75 million in value. They are not legally binding. But an advocate for large investors says the revolt at Dex One stands out as one of a small handful of instances in which shareholders rejected executives' pay packages. Of the 2,300 companies studied by Institutional Shareholder Services, only 37 of the compensation plans got a thumbs down, and shareholder support averaged 91%, ISS spokesman Ted Allen said. It's pretty rare for companies to receive majority opposition, Allen says. If companies continue to have poor shareholder returns, I think you'll see most of them change their pay practices. So far, few of the 37 companies have responded to the advisory votes, Allen says. In a report prior to the annual vote at Dex One, ISS advised shareholders to vote against the pay packages, citing the company's above-average pay structure for executives and its lack of formal clawback policy to retrieve compensation in certain cases of disappointing financial performance. At the same time, ISS supported the Dex One directors who were up for election. Dex One's predecessor company, R.H. Donnelley Corporation, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization in May 2009. It emerged on February 1, 2010, with an initial public offering and a new shareholder base. The new company posted revenue of $161 million in the April-June quarter, up 134% from last year. It has been modestly profitable in terms of cash flow, but two massive write-downs of intangible assets have led it to report accounting losses totaling nearly $1 billion in the last four quarters. Its share price has zagged steadily downward from the $31 IPO price to close at $1.14 on September 14. Gustafson cites that steep decline in the lawsuit and contrasted it with what the lawsuit describes as excessive pay. Several attorneys at corporate law firms say plaintiffs' attorneys have filed shareholder derivative actions often, and perhaps reflexively, in response to mergers, acquisitions, and other transactions, only to settle for payment almost immediately. The lawsuit against X1 does not appear to fit into that category, they note. Wyrick Robbins partner Lee Whitman says shareholder derivative actions of the quick and reflexive variety have waned in recent years as corporations defend themselves more aggressively. It's gotten harder for plaintiffs to succeed, Whitman says. S&P issues warning on bonds Purdue wants for loops. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. And also accompanying this picture is a picture of Governor Beverly Perdue. The caption reads, Governor Beverly Perdue has suggested use of Garvey bonds. Standard & Poor's, the ratings agency that ruffled feathers when it downgraded U.S. long-term debt, has turned its attention to the financing tool North Carolina wants to use to pay for highway loops around six Tar Heel cities. At the center of the debate are so-called Garvey bonds, a special kind of debt that states issue in their own names to build roads, but pledge anticipated federal highway grants to pay off. Since 2005, North Carolina has issued $530 million of such bonds and plans to up that amount to $1 billion over the next several years. Governor Beverly Perdue recently endorsed Garvey as the financing prescription for outer loop jobs around Greenville, Fayetteville, Greensboro, and three other cities. But S&P, in a recent report, hoisted warning flags saying states could see their Garvey bonds rating lowered. What's prompting S&P jitters, say S&P analyst Adam Torres, are uncertainties over budget cuts in Washington, D.C. Not only might Congress simply cut federal spending on transportation projects in general, Torres and two other S&P analysts reason, but lawmakers might not reauthorize an 18.4 cents per gallon federal gasoline tax that's scheduled to expire on September 30, or pass a pending road resurfacing bill. Since the states get proceeds from all three, any or all of the above possibilities would slash their federal highway intake and therefore the ability of states to finance Garvey packages. For the time being, S&P is holding North Carolina's Garvey rating and outlook at AA and stable. Back in March, Fitch, another New York-based rater, cut the Garvey outlook, not rating, of North Carolina and a dozen other states from stable to negative because of the same federal funding uncertainties, according to Fitch's Cindy Stoller. A full-scale ratings downgrade, if it happened, would leave the state facing higher borrowing costs as investors would demand steeper rates of interest. That would leave the state using larger slices of its federal highway dollars to pay off each Garvey project. The state's overall AAA general obligation bond rating wouldn't be affected since North Carolina doesn't back Garvey projects with state money. North Carolina Department of Transportation spokeswoman Nicole Meister says DOT officials are closely following the same funding issues as the S&P analysts, but have not lost faith in Garvey bonds. Without them, paving the remaining 213 miles to complete a half dozen outer loop projects would take 50 years. With them, according to DOT estimates, construction on the various projects can begin between 2015 and 2020. Duke Health losing chief medical officer to Giant HCA. Dr. Michael Cuff worked his way up to top physician job during a 24-year career with Duke. And that's the headline on our next article. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Durham. And within the article, there is a face shot of Dr. Michael Cuff. Duke University Health Systems Dr. Michael Cuff, a 24-year veteran who only recently took the top medical post for the massive healthcare operation, is leaving. Officials at for-profit Hospital Corporation of America confirmed that Cuff will become president and chief executive officer of physician services for HCA. But talk had been swirling at the Duke University Health System about the move for some time. It's cool, if you will, that it's a Duke guy, says Dr. Carl E. Raven in the radiology department. Part of the university's mission is to train the leaders of tomorrow, Raven says, and this is an example of Duke doing just that. It's sort of a feather in our cap. HCA did not release compensation figures, but company CEO Richard M. Bracken received $38 million in total compensation last year, according to a Securities and Exchange filing. CFO R. Milton Johnson received $22 million, and three presidents earned a combined $40 million in 2010. Bracken's total compensation was up more than tenfold that of his 2008 compensation, and the compensations of the other executive officers were on similar trajectories. Cuff's compensation at Duke last year was $589,504, according to Form 990 tax information. He will report to Dr. Jonathan B. Perlin, HCA's chief medical officer. The move comes only a few weeks after Cuff took over as vice president of ambulatory care services and was named Duke's chief medical officer. He initially declined to be considered for the job, but after Duke leadership did not find a suitable candidate, he agreed to take the post. I am incredibly grateful for my 24 years at Duke and believe that Duke remains better positioned for success than any academic medical center in the country, Cuff says. Though my family and I have been committed to Duke and to the Triangle, the move to HCA represented an unparalleled professional opportunity. Since 2005, Cuff was the vice president for medical affairs. He received an MD and an MBA from Duke University and is a graduate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dr. Cuff's experience and success in a number of complex leadership roles at the Duke University Health System uniquely prepare him to lead HCA Physician Services, says Perlin. Based in Nashville, Tennessee, HCA operates 164 hospitals and 111 ambulatory surgery centers. It generates more than $30 billion in annual revenue and employs 190,000. In the first 6 months of 2011, it reported $654 million of net income. Duke Health generates $2.4 billion in revenue and reported $431 million in net revenue over expenses in 2010. The move to a more administrative position did not surprise Raven. Like Cuffy, more doctors have earned MBA degrees over the past decade and moved to the front office. We are seeing more physicians beginning to change their focus toward the business aspects of the job, Raven says. I think this is a reflection of that. When Cuff takes his new role on October 26, he'll leave behind a hole that might not be easily filled, says Dr. John Weinerth, Associate Medical School Dean and Director of Duke's Graduate Medical Education Program. He may have had the title of VP and CMO, but in many ways he was also the institution's personal physician in the most admirable definition of that term, Weinerth says. He was competent, intelligent, dedicated, concerned, caring, and willing to assist in any way he could for the benefit of the institution, the people who worked there, and all the patients it served. Indeed, Raven predicted that the position would be split among as many as five different people. Planes from RDU get a little more roomy, but not for long. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Chris Bagley with a dateline of Morrisville, and it's accompanied by a large picture of passengers checking in at an American Airlines terminal at RDU International Airport. The addition of several new flights from Raleigh-Durham International Airport in the last year has given passengers a bit of legroom, but that appears likely to disappear in coming months as airlines cut capacity yet again to shore up profits amid high fuel prices. UBM Aviation, a consulting firm, says passenger numbers at RDU in the January to July period rose by 1.5% from the first 7 months of 2010. Flights total capacity, total seats available, meanwhile, grew by 2.9%, leading average load factor, percentage of seats sold, to fall to 74.9% from 78.3%. The airport's own statistics show capacity growing even more dramatically in the first 7 months of 2011 by nearly 6% from the same period of 2010. It wasn't immediately clear whether new flights have made existing flights significantly less crowded by drawing away passengers, or whether lower load factors on new flights have merely pulled down the average. But local flyers' comments on social media sites such as Twitter suggest that planes remain crowded. Recent additions at RDU include a weekly Continental Airlines flight to Cancun, Mexico, twice weekly flights to Freeport, Bahamas on Vision Airlines, and most recently multiple daily flights to Baltimore on Delta Airlines. Airport spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin also pointed to Delta's discontinuation of service to Albany, New York and Providence, Rhode Island, and to discontinued Midwest Connect service to Milwaukee. Monthly load factors at the airport hit all-time highs at around 87% in July 2010. Statistics from the airport and UBM show modest growth in passenger numbers in the first 3 months of 2011, followed by small declines this summer as high oil prices help push up airfares, which UBM and other industry analysts in turn have blamed for slowing growth in passenger numbers. Airlines and other airports have reported similar trends. Hillsboro resident Deborah Edwards, who flies about once a month for her job in training and technical support with GE Healthcare, says she has noticed lighter loads this year between Charlotte and RDU and to other non-hub cities. While flights between hubs are still quite full, RDU is not a hub airport, but Charlotte is. Dallas, Texas-based Southwest Airlines Company, the dominant carrier at Raleigh-Durham, said last week that available seat miles, the industry's benchmark capacity measure, grew by 4.2% last month from August 2010, compared to growth in passenger miles of just 3.9%. If the demand growth remains stagnant, airlines may respond by either reducing capacity or raising the average fares to counteract the year-on-year reduction in RDU revenue, UBM spokeswoman Andy Riggs said. Delta, Raleigh-Durham's number two carrier in terms of total passengers, appears to be responding already. Delta plans to cut its global capacity by 2-3% in 2012. Ditto for American Airlines, the number three carrier at the airport. Beverly Goulet, an executive with Fort Worth-based parent company AMR Corporation, said at a conference this week that American plans to cut its total seat capacity by at least 0.5% in the last 3 months of the year. American is taking a very close look at its plans for capacity next year, the Wall Street Journal quoted her as saying. That could mean that American is considering a slowdown in its transition from 140-seat MD-80s toward 160-seat Boeing 737s, Goulet said. Airlines haven't announced specific plans to cut flights at Raleigh-Durham. On the contrary, Southwest plans to begin service to and from Atlanta in February. Southwest's parent company, which purchased AirTran Airways earlier this year, has said it has no immediate plans to alter AirTran's multiple daily flights to Atlanta. And now with our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Duke, UNC, NCSU rank high. Triangle universities again rank highly on the U.S. News and World Report national rankings. Duke University ranked 10th overall in the nation, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill ranked 29th overall, and fifth among public universities. North Carolina State University ranked 101st overall and 45th among public universities. Triangle universities have enjoyed a long run of ranking highly, with Duke placing in the top 10 for the 23rd consecutive year and UNC Chapel Hill ranking in the public university top 5 for 11 years running. Oblinger to head Dole Institute. James Oblinger, who resigned as chancellor of NC State University in the midst of allegations that the wife of the sitting governor was an improper hire for the university, will take over leadership of the David H. Murdoch Research Institute at the NC Research Campus in Kannapolis near Charlotte. The institute was established by Dole Food Company owner David Murdoch in a partnership with the state to establish the campus. Oblinger succeeds Michael Luther, who resigned as president but stayed on as chief business officer. coastal developer bankrupt. A second coastal housing venture in 2 weeks has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization, leaving in question the future of half a square mile of waterfront property. The entity, Bath Bridgewater South LLC, appears to be related to Bridgewater at Bath South Project, a development north of New Bern. A Chapter 11 filing allows a company to delay repayment of debt while it reorganizes its business. Companies that emerge from Chapter 11 are typically healthier but often smaller than when they filed. Duke Energy lands $675 million pact. The Austin, Texas City Council has approved a 25-year contract with Duke Energy Renewables to buy power from the second phase of a massive 400-megawatt wind farm Duke is building in West Texas. The city will pay up to $675 million over the contract life to buy all the power produced by the 200-megawatt Los Vientos II project in Cameron and Willacy counties. Original estimates had pegged the value of the contract at up to $820 million, but the total projected output of the farm was reduced after Duke made final decisions on equipment purchases and refined calculations on power production. Carries human-centric bankrupt. Human-Centric Technologies Incorporated has filed for bankruptcy liquidation, according to court records. The Cary-based design firm, which served the medical, consumer products, and information technology industries, cited $1.1 million in debt and $37,000 in assets in its Chapter 7 bankruptcy filing on Friday. The filing put a value of more than $100,000 on accrued vacation owed to employees and $75,000 on the firm's outstanding credit card debt. Human-Centric Technologies was formed in 2000 when Barry Beath, who headed a 15-employee division of Monterey Technologies, spun off the arm into a separate company. Beath had founded Human Factors Interfaces in 1986 and merged the company with California-based Monterey in 1990. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.